to limit this talk only to the things which are most relevant to what the Buddha has taught. Now, when you look at it, Buddhism and what the Buddha teach are sometimes very different. A lot of things which Buddhists do or Buddhists teach are not what the Buddha has taught. It's just like that. It happened because, it can be an analogy of it is, the Buddha has baked us a very nice, beautiful, good-tasting cake. But as the cake is handed down to different places, they say, okay, I make it look a bit nicer. Or they try to. They put more icing on it. They put more icing, handed down through the ages. They put even more icing on it. Eventually, the icing becomes, you know, all sorts of things. It can be a house, can be a whatever. And usually, for those people who try to change a very good teacher's teaching, they change the whole thing into a Mickey Mouse. And what you see nowadays is just Mickey Mouse. And this Mickey Mouse is just what we call the trappings of religion. It's not a bad thing, because this Mickey Mouse will attract a lot of people. But what we got to see is whether we can differentiate the icing from the cake. From the outside, we can't see the cake. We can see only the icing. So, whatever it is, tonight, I'm not going to talk about the icing. You know that there's a lot of icing. You ask me to pray, how many incense sticks should I offer to the Buddha, or how should I bathe the Buddha on the Buddha ceremony, and so on. I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to talk to is the core teachings of Buddhism. It's a very, very simple teaching which anybody can understand. But because it's so simple, therefore people try to put their own ideas into it and make it more complicated. When the Buddha started preaching, he didn't talk about all these rituals and things. He just only talked about one simple thing. The simple thing he talked about is the problems. Now, when you live in this world, we have a lot of problems. We can have problems with other people. We can have a lot of problems with ourselves even. Sit down there quietly, minding your own business. What comes up? A lot of worries, fear, disappointments. And when they're facing the world, all the other things, we seem to think that, oh, they're putting pressure on me and so on. So that is precisely what the Buddha started on. Now, for those of you who have read the life of the Buddha, the legend or the history of the Buddha, you realize that it's recorded that he, as a young man, he was quite pretty well off, right? He's living in a very good surrounding, and in fact, the books call him a prince, right? And he lives in fairly luxurious surrounding. And for most of us, when you have got that sort of life, you shouldn't have any worries. But it's not the fact. You ask any of those really rich people, they got more worries than people who have got nothing. Right? So his usual trappings, you know, with all his luxuries and all these things, he found that there's a lot of things which is worrying him or bothering him. So in the story as well, he said that one day he went out to his for a tour of his own country, and he saw for a few things. Right? Some of the things that are very disturbing to him is sickness, a sick person, an old person, as well as a dead person. Right? Those really bothered him. And he tried to get a lot of, he tried to ask a lot of people, but nobody can answer him. Why do we get old? Why do we fall sick? Why do we die? And all this. Right? That question until now, nobody can answer. You know why? Because we ask the question wrongly. We ask why. When you ask question why, we can get satisfactory answer up to a certain stage. And towards there, after there, you can't go any further. So usually, when it becomes a religion, people talk about, when you ask why and why and why, you end up something like, you either accept what I say or not. So, and if you look at the core teachings of the Buddha, he never answers why. There are a lot of things the Buddha never answered at all, because that's irrelevant. What is relevant to us are this sort of what we call life's problems. Now, where do these problems originate? Now, I don't say why, where. This problem originates from our sort of ignorance, right? Our ignorance to a lot of things. When you ask why, nobody can answer you perfectly, because those people who are explaining to you are also ignorant. I may be a bit cleverer than you, but towards the end there, I'm still very stupid. Stupid in the sense that I've got this ignorance, I've got this delusion. I don't look at things in the right perspective. So, since nobody could answer the Buddha's question, and he at his time, he asked the question wrongly. He asked why. Why they deny, why we have got to grow old and so on. Then he eventually left home and he went through a wandering life, trying to get his answer. And that's happened to most of us. We sometimes, you know, you sit down quietly, do it towards the things, and then, why should I feel like this? And you get this anger, frustration, fear, worries, and all this. You ask us, why? And we find no answer. If we try to ask more, then we get really frustrated, and we bring this anger onto other people, or this fear and worry to other people. So, towards the end, the Buddha has got to give up a lot of this quest, and then he sat down under the tree, and he contemplated, and he found the answer. The answer not to why, but to how. How come we get sick, and so on and so forth. Now, after that, he formulated, or he gave his teachings to a lot of people, and different people understood his teachings differently. But the core of it is still the same. So if, for those of you who have read Buddhist book or listened to other Dhamma talks, you know that they talk about Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths is actually the main gist of the Buddha's teachings. Now the reason why it's called truth is because it cannot be denied. Nobody can deny it. And when it's a truth, everybody can relate to it. What you can't relate to is not the truth to you. So when you can relate it to it, then it becomes the truth. And the truth is that, the first truth, put in a religious term, is called dukkha. Dukkha is a state of suffering, as translated, or unsatisfactoriness. You find it in life, we have a lot of this. Your stress, fear, anger, worries, disappointments, you can name it, jealousy, and so on and so forth. But all these things which comes within us and reacting to outside influences. And that, the result of how the mind reacts to it, or the state of mind at the time when we are in that condition, is what we call dukkha. Just imagine when you're scared of something. Suddenly, for most uni students, if you are not prepared for exams and you got to go and sit for exam, that moment when you get into the exam hall, that panic, the fear, you get it. I don't have to describe to you, you know it. So when you know it, what's it? It's a truth. You don't have to believe me. Belief in the Buddha's teaching, belief does not come in at all. Everything the Buddha mentioned can be experienced by all. So the first truth is, there you are, and I talk about fear, that feeling and the fear. I can't describe to you. When you are jealous, what happens? That sort of feeling you get. You don't feel nice about it. And how can I, we say you feel miserable, but that misery cannot be described with words. It's just everybody who felt it, who experienced it, will feel it. Now, and the Buddha said, in living, in existence, that is unavoidable. We do, I'm quite sure, for all of us, nobody can deny that. We do that. The moment you open the eyes, and the moment you close, shut your eyes when you sleep, you are influenced by those things. And those things are what we call the reaction between us and the outside, of us and things within us. So this reaction and action is part of the second noble truth. It tells you how that suffering or unsatisfactoriness, or put it in the original term, dukkha, arises. Everything, nothing arises without a cause. There will be a cause there. So this is, second one is the cause of dukkha. What causes it? And in this course, we've got to understand another thing that's in existence, in our existence in this world. That's a very important thing. It's not important, it's a thing, a characteristic of existence. One of them is impermanence. We change. For us now, physically we can see the change. Or sometimes we don't want to feel the change. No, I'm just the same old Jim. But if you take a photograph of me, say 60 years ago and now, 60 years ago I was just a kid going to kindergarten. So, you look at it, now, is that Jim the same Jim, or is it a different Jim? Now, in all respect, it's all the same thing, but how come this is, the fella, you know, the fella has got a lot more hair, he hasn't lost his milk teeth yet, and then no wrinkles, nothing?
That tells you of change. Impermanence is change. We change all the time. But what we can see, the changes we can see are the physical ones. And in existence, we change. No, nobody can be can say that or can will that he or she does not grow old. When you come to a certain age, we can pretend to not to grow old. That's why the supermarket or David Jones is full of those expensive cosmetic products, or Botox or whatever, just put on and then put the cracks there. And look. Now, in reality, we still grow old. So that is the thing. The Buddha talked about this impermanence. Now the impermanence of the physical body can be seen, but the impermanence of the mind is even faster. We've got a certain way we think, and we are influenced by a lot of things which we experience from outside, we see, we hear, and so on. And that sort of things can make us change our mind just like that. Now if you see me yesterday and today, I'll still be more or less the same. I'm just one day older, it doesn't make much difference. But my mind yesterday and my mind today can undergo a lot of change. Sometimes, you know, you hear something, and the impact is so great that all of a sudden, what your mind has got previously just simply evaporates. You change into a new person. So, this is, again, the impermanence related to the mind. Now, as if we have got these two impermanence going, then the Buddha came up with another teaching. He says, then where is the real person? Is the person yesterday, is the Jim yesterday real, or is the Jim now real? But when I say I'm the real Jim, I've already gone to the next moment, and I've got a different Jim already. So, that is the other way the Buddha taught. Because of this impermanence, we change that fast, that at no time we can pinpoint ourselves to say, I'm definitely like that. So, that's the other teachings which we call anatta. A lot of people say non-self and all these things. But we can say that this non-self idea is because of this change. Therefore, we cannot pinpoint that particular person as what it is. And that non-self can be easily proven the other way too. That when you look at me, all of you, 25 or 30 of you, will have different ideas about me. So, but there are certain ideas which you have in common. For example, you see that this is he. He looks like an older person, male, right? Asian and so on. All these things are because of our previous influence which we get from outside. You have never seen an Asian before, or then you won't know. Or maybe you have never seen Jim before. Mingta has seen me many times, so he knows me. Eh? So from far, I can say, oh, that's Jim. Whereas for a lot of you who have never seen me before, when I walk from far, I say, oh, that's an older person there walking towards me. So which is the real Jim? So even for people who know us, they might not know us so well as to be able to know the mind. So again, which is the real person? Or, better still, if you have known me for ages, my mind still changed, and when you say, I know Jim, then my mind has already been changed. So, again, it's where is the real person? So this is the, when you read about this anatta, it's talking about these other things, the non-self.
But it's not that the person does not exist. The person whom we think is does not exist. That's the whole thing. Then the third one is when these two coming together, impermanence and the person who does not want to exist, especially when it deals with your own self, and if you get this self coming up, and if you cannot deal with the sort of changes, then dukkha arises. Right? So these are the three, what they call universal characteristics of existence. Now, having known about these universal characteristics, then we got to see, how does dukkha arise within us? I said just now, because of impermanence and all the things, because it changes, therefore, we get into the state of dukkha. So the second noble truth explains that. It tells us, you know, if you look at it, the Buddha's core teaching actually talks a lot on the mentality or the psychology of things. It deals with how the mind makes us react with things outside and therefore allows us to come to a certain state, and the state usually ends up being unwholesome state, or the state which causes a lot of suffering or unsatisfactoriness. So tonight I might talk a lot more about that as well, because if you look at the core, as you go in and in and in, that is precisely where everything starts. The Buddha didn't teach us because he wants to be known as a famous teacher. He doesn't want power as well. If you look at the scripture, the last days of the Buddha, despite being such a great teacher, well honored by a lot of people, from the nobility to the poorest, he's really honored. At the age of 80, and he knew that he was going to die within a few months, what he did, he carried his three ropes, walked along with his attendant who is a middle-aged person called Ananda, and he carried his ball and walked. He could have asked the king to provide him a chariot. Right? Over, you know, if he's like a lot of these modern-day religious people, he go into a murk, right? Or call the Buddha mobile, bulletproof. But he didn't. Not even a chariot. When he was walking, a lot of his disciples passed by in chariots. There's one case where the warrior caste, the Lichavis, came in and stopped the chariots and didn't even offer him a lift. He didn't get upset either. The Buddha did, what the Lichavis did was to say, "Will you come to our place for lunch tomorrow? I will give you offering." And then they drove away. So the Buddha did not go, you can see, he's a humble man. He didn't go for really all this luxury. So that's how he was. He goes through all his communities and taught them the same thing. And that's what we are going to talk about tonight. Now, when you look at... Yeah, I better use the bonnet. Any color preference? Anybody you like, don't like red? I'll use black. I like the idea. Any of you seen this Balinese peanuts? Those from Indonesia? They're that small. The shell. So that's what we are going to do. Now, everything has got to have a starting point. Right? So we have the starting point as ourselves. Okay. That's you, that's me. Now, don't look at other people now. Just simply focus on yourself. Now, within this person, whom I call I, right, what have you got here? You got this mind, right, and the body. Okay? This mind provides us with this thing. One of the things which the mind provides is consciousness. This consciousness is to be aware of things. Now, we have got this body. You can see this body of ours. You can feel the body. And in this body, if you look at the mirror, you can see that you've got eyes, right? Ears, nose, tongue, and the whole body itself, other than these four other things. Now, you know why we call this? All these four are still part of the body, but the reason why we have these four separately is they are receptacles or receiving organs. They receive impulses and signals from outside. Right? And then the other one is, don't actually have got a, don't have to receive signal from outside, but can produce their own signal, is what we call the mind. Or you can say, put it more simpler as brain. Again, the physical organ is brain, but actually deals with the mind. Now, we have got this, and still it doesn't give us trouble. You know, you've got the eyes and all these things. It doesn't give you trouble. The trouble comes when you've got to see things. Right? Now, the things which you do is, eyes will be looking at form. A form means something, is a shape, a size, whatever. Right? And then the ear is the sound. Right? Nose, smell. Tongue means taste. Body is touch. And the brain is thoughts. So these are the basis, the thing which we receive. And receive what? All these things, the signals. When you look at the car, you've got the signal already. When you hear a sound, there is a signal. And this signal has got impact on us. Well, I'm not talking about impact yet, but when you have eyes and there's this form, we still cannot see. If we do not have what we call the corresponding consciousness. But that means you've got to have this eye consciousness. A person who has lost his ability to see, or people who are blind, or we call it what nowadays, the politically correct, visually handicapped or something like that. So when people who are blind cannot see, so when you don't have that consciousness, then same thing with this, you've got to have the ear consciousness. People who are deaf cannot hear. And sometimes when you are temporarily deaf, and you get to hear a big explosion and the ears don't function, the eardrums, the nerves are in recess, then you don't hear, okay? Same thing with smell, you got to have the nose consciousness. The nose consciousness comes from the cells around the back of the nose. Right? And usually when we have got flu or cold or whatever, we cannot smell. Same thing with the tongue consciousness, the body is the body consciousness. And the mind is the consciousness itself. This consciousness also is related to these other five consciousness. Right? So you've got to have the general consciousness. Now this consciousness is what we call awareness. And part of it is also to do with our memory, our experience. The sum total of memory experience. Is there any question up to now? Am I getting too fast or too slow or too dumb? But if I feel like this is a talk, it's actually what I'm doing is a very simple way of looking at the Buddhist psychology. I mean, this is the way, you know, from your own, the way our mental state is influences our actions. Right? Okay, so when you got these things, the very, very basic conditions are there already. There are also other conditions which comes in. There may be millions of conditions which come in. But without these three, nothing can happen. So without the eye, you cannot see. You cannot have this eye conscious, and so on. Right? So you can see that this six and six and six, these 18 things, can be likened to the way we create things. We have ideas about things. Right? This idea is creation. When you see a person, you create idea about that person. You can see, okay, we agree that this is a man and so on and so forth, but after that, what happens? You think, okay, what is he? What's he up to? What can he do? What's going to be tomorrow with him and so on and so forth? You think about that. And this one becomes our idea. When you hear something, the same thing. And you see a car going screeching past there, what happens? Our mind goes with it in the first place. Then we start to interpret. But what we actually did was hearing that sound. Then, because of our memory and experiences, that sound goes, that's a car. The car will go screeching. We might not know whether it's, no. Then after that you say, okay, it can be an old car, it can be a new car, and so on. Of course, nobody in their right mind would think that the Mercedes will go around there screeching like that. And when you see cars screeching, usually it's done by young people. They've got an old bomb or something in the olden days. Cheap cars, therefore they can go afford to go screeching. So, then we start to get ideas. There's a cheap car, you think about. What? The olden days, I used to use example of a Torana. Nowadays, you don't have Toranas around, because Torana is driven by all the Yahoos up in the western suburbs. So, now, when you hear that, what happens? When you hear the car screeching, we build up stories about it. Right? And people of my age, people of the suburb I come from, people think very different, in the same way. It must be driven by one of those young people from the western suburbs, or the Westies as we call them. Then in winter, we imagine them on a checkered duffel coat going down, and then they start to get angry. These young people got no sense of whatever. There you are. From hearing a sound, we start to get angry already without even looking outside the window. Right? So this is the way we go around courting things all the time. Right? Now, of course, when I talk about the other conditions, for example, take an example like the sea, right? The action of seeing. If there's no light, you can't see. Right now, if in the total darkness, you've got a perfectly good eyes, you've got perfectly good eye consciousness, if there's a thing in front of you, in total darkness, you still can't see. That's why you come into things in darkness. So these are the other conditions. When there's in the vacuum, there's no sound, and then the thing doesn't touch the senses, the cells in their nose, we get no smell, and so on and so forth. Right? So, and in these sort of things, you can find that another thing which we can see about it, this 5 years got limits. We can see as far as the nearest obstacle, right? I can see through the wall because there's a wall there. I can put a wall here, okay, that's how far I can see. Or if there's no wall, nothing, I can see as far as the horizon. That's how I can see. And there's also a range for sounds. For example, depends on how loud the sound is, I can't hear a sound, a bomb going out in Japan, right? Because it's out of range. So there's a range of it. A nose even closer. If the odor, those cells, those molecules of the smell don't touch the sensory cells in the nose, they don't smell at all. Tasting the same thing, tongue. You've got to touch your tongue. You've got to touch at the right part of the tongue. If you've got this part of the tongue which can sense only sour things and you put the salt on it, it won't work at all. So that's this range here. But for this mind, there's no range. The mind, it works wonders. For example, I say, okay, now let's go to the end of the galaxy. You're all there already. Whether the galaxy is real or not, I don't know. Right? Same thing, you go to the end of the galaxy, you look at Jim. Right? Let's say, look at Jim. You saw Jim, everything you think about Jim is there. But is that the real Jim or not? It's just like the idea you have towards the end of the galaxy. So that's the way we go and look into things. And the looking at things that way is what the Buddha called. This ignorance does not reflect on our intelligence. We might have got an IQ of 180. But it does not free us from this ignorance. This ignorance is not being able to look into the true nature of things. True nature of phenomena. This is another great word which I've learned when I get into Buddhism. Again, you know about phenomena or phenomenon. It's not the dictionary explains something as occurrence or something happening. But in the Buddhist way, this phenomena is a lot more than it. It explains to you how all these things happen. So when you talk about how these things happen, then go back to this person. You look at other people, we are still be speculating and guessing. Right? And you say, okay, I think I know how you think, but you can never get it right. You're just thinking of what it is. So the Buddha always tells us to bring the thing back to our self. So to understand his teachings a lot better, we use, go back to this so-called I. That's the way I get things. Now in this particular person, again, this mind and the body. And this mind, the main part of it is this consciousness. And what this Buddha taught us is the mind conditions the body conditions the mind. Without the body, the mind doesn't work. Without the mind, the body doesn't work. I mean, is that the truth? There's a lot of bodies in the morgue without mind. That's why they're just there. You can cut them up and they won't even flinch a muscle. Nothing happens. So, body. And what it actually means is you, or me, we are ready for actions. And what's our actions? We get into the state of trouble. Right? We get into this dukkha. Or this unsatisfactoriness. Now how to link these two? It's a process of it. This process is when you got this person ready to go. The first thing is we are equipped with this thing. Then we come into contact with things. So this is this contact. Contact meaning the first thing which happens with this sand basis and this. Assuming that you've got this consciousness, then you come to contact. So when eyes come to contact with that thing, now of course, you know, when I see what's that, straight away, you know, they tell me that's a Buddha image. But if you go to a place where nobody has seen Buddha images before, what is that? Or worse still, some will say, that is the Buddha. A lot of Buddhists think that. I tell the story once, you know, people think that it's a sacred thing to a lot of Buddhists. Right? You cannot touch it. You must clean your hands properly, wash with soap, put in flour, and all the perfume before you can touch the Buddha. Then when they carry the Buddha, they carry above the head, you know, and all those things depend on the background. Now, what we see is actually, before it becomes a Buddha, what actually happens? The eyes come into contact with that thing. And then when you come into contact, naturally, if your eyes work, if the eye consciousness is there, and the general awareness is there, you get a sensation. Right? Say for example, like, my hand touches one. I got a sensation. That's this sensation. Same thing, then you get a sensation when it goes bang somewhere, or somebody goes in the seat, you know. There's a sensation there, a sound. Right? Or when somebody's cooking next door, you find that there's a sensation also, a smell. So this is a sensation. And when you have this sensation, there's certain parts of the mind starts to work. Now, because of consciousness, then we start to do it in a way as is, to perceive the thing. Perception is just recognizing the thing. And where does this recognition come from? From our memory and experience. The other part of the mind. This is perception. Okay, this perception is what? We give it a value. It's a cup. Oh, that is it. See that one? It's got this particular shape. And for those of you who are used to seeing Buddha image, this particular shape, then what happens? The idea comes up, it's a Buddha. You perceive it to be a Buddha. Right? And then the next thing which happens straight after perception is, not only we give the value to it, but our own opinion comes in. It's a beautiful image. It's an ugly one. Right? It comes from Thailand. It comes from Sri Lanka. All this, and we are building up stories, putting input on it. Right? There's sometimes millions of inputs per short moment. All these things, okay, that's a Buddha. Now, after that, after the perception, I see this Buddha, that it's whatever it is, a nice or not nice,
it becomes the mental formation. And a lot of translations say volition. This mental formation has got two parts of it. The first part is, say it's a very nice Buddha, or it's not nice, or whatever. Then the second part of it is what I'm going to do to it. So, for a lot of people, this pious Buddhist, when you see a Buddha image, it's natural that they put their hands up like that. Pray to the Buddha or to give respect to the Buddha. So this, before they actually put their hands together like that, there's also a mental formation saying, I must respect the thing. So, when you have this sensation, all these things arise. When this thing arises, then the next step will be craving. This craving is, what do you say, cravings for the things we see and we smell and we taste and all these things. Craving. Now, this craving allows us to grip on the thing in a stronger way. You get a sensation, then okay, I must look at it a second time, look at more about it. Like it, dislike it. So, when you have, before you can really crave that, after this mental formation, it should give you a pleasant or unpleasant sensation before you can crave. If things which are nice, what happens? Pull. Things which are not nice, push. So the craving, you don't think that we crave for something which is good. We crave for things which are bad too, because we're trying to push it away. And if the more you can't push it away, the more you think about it. Right? And then from there, it starts the thing which you call clinging. Now this clinging, in the stage of clinging, this personal preferences, our habitual thinking pattern and all these things starts to fall. The I, the mind, the ego and everything. All this happens. It's not as slow as what I tell you. It happens from one moment to the next. Very, very quickly. Right? When you see the Buddha image, what happens? And you see this cup, what happens? How come you got this cup and I got a plastic cup? Yeah. See the ideas and everything. In fact, you've gone beyond this. Right? Because the thing is, habitually we think that way. Right? So, you cling to the eye, and then the habits, right? And so on. That's where the I comes in. My cup, your cup. But my cup is better than your cup, again. And this is the way we think. And then this is the becoming, when it gets worse and worse and worse. Right? And this, when this state of becoming, this arises this intention. Right? This intention is the way we think of wanting to do. This intention can make us think more. In fact, this is the beginning of the thought. So we think, okay, this intention. If I see that, how come he get this cup and I get a plastic cup? Then the intention is to feel unhappy about it. Right? So when you feel unhappy, then it goes back. The unhappiness becomes the thing of contact for the mind already. First thing. Then it gets worse and worse, then I must go and tell Ming that next time we Australia, we are very egalitarian. How come you give the speaker this cup and give us the plastic cup? It must be equal. So this is the whole thing, right? You know, when you start to complain, or when we start to complain, or we do things like that, what happens in the mind? Are you happy or not? So when it comes to becoming, then this is the birth. Right? The birth of a deed. This deed can be in your thoughts or your physical actions. The thought is the thing of worse and worse. It goes round and round and round many times within the next 2 seconds. And that's where you say, okay, now let's go and tell those damn Buddhists that they are useless. How can they go? This Buddha says you don't discriminate. Okay. Then trouble starts. Of course, this don't stay for a long time. Eventually, the idea, you know, it stays with us for some while, some time, and then there'll be aging and death. And death of this particular cycle. And then this particular cycle, the usual is before it's starts to get aging, it goes back again and renews itself. Then you get more and more and more problems.
So does this describe all our mental behavior? Any disagreement?
Same thing with happy things, right? You see something which is really nice, come to contact with it. Then you recognize the thing, something really nice, perception and for me. And I want it for myself. Then after that, what shall I do with it? So I say, okay, this cup is very nice. I don't have this cup at home. You know the next one I'm going to do, right? So either I ask Ninta for it, to say, can you spare this cup or not? That'd be very nice. Can I spare this cup or not? You say, no, it's public, our property. Okay, all right. When you go, everybody goes out then. Goes around again, how can I acquire this cup as my own? And so when you don't see it, I just put it in a pocket and walk around. So the other one is the deed of stealing happens. And when I'm planning all these things, do you think my mind is in a calm state or not? It's a happy thing for me to do, to steal this cup. I own this cup next time. But the thing is, since I committed this, next time he comes to visit me in my house, I can't have this cup outside. So just for one single deed of pinching this cup, I have all these things. And then any guys from Unibus who come to my house, okay, make sure that it's not there. Right? So this is the whole thing, the way we do. We get into trouble upon trouble upon trouble. Now you have heard about Buddhist stories. Sometimes you see some Buddhist painting about this fat, laughing monk carrying a big bag, a sack. It can be interpreted many ways, but one of the ways of interpreting is he's telling us that we go around with a big sack in our back and keep on carrying all this thing and putting it in. Right? No wonder we find a burden. It gets heavier and heavier. We are actually so-called suffering our past behavior as well. Now we talk about this behavior, these actions and so on. What does it mean? Comes to the third thing. Comes to another thing which the Buddha taught. It's a very, very important in Buddhism, this karma. But unfortunately, karma and the other word is these two words are the most misunderstood words in the West, and it's also to a lot of people is most misunderstood among the Buddhists as well. Let's start with Nirvana. In the first place, Nirvana, people think that Nirvana is a sort of heaven, the place you go to when you're happy, you go to Nirvana. Well, I haven't gone to Nirvana yet, so I can't tell you exactly what it is, right? But I can tell you that you're happy, you don't go to Nirvana. And you only go to heaven. And this karma is the same thing. A lot of times they use the word karma. When somebody is suffering, oh, bad karma. And so on, we tend to use these sort of things very liberally without really knowing what it is. Now, what I've been trying to tell you just now, explaining all these things, is karma. How karma happens. When you start to have this birth, you do this thing, karma actually means a deed. What you do is called karma. You say, you react, bodily actions, and so on. Right? Spitting is a karma. Punching people is a karma. Being nice is also a karma. So this karma, we don't say good or bad. Sometimes when, for example, restraining people from doing things is bad karma sometimes. Right? But sometimes when you restrain people to other things, can be a good karma. So this karma is something which we do, and it depends on the results. Right? And in Buddhist, we are looking at it, we've got two kinds of karma, or three kinds. The wholesome and unwholesome and neutral. There are very few neutral karma. Most of the karma we commit are wholesome and unwholesome. So in talk about this, what is this wholesome and unwholesome? Why don't I use good and bad? Because this concept of good and bad is relative to what you think. Sometimes, a lot of people say,
oh, doing this thing is bad, but actually it's good for some good results coming out of it. Or sometimes they say this is good, but bad results will come out of it. Right? It's all to do with our the way we judge things, so we don't use this good and bad. This wholesome and unwholesomeness, we've got to look what is the result. The result of it, the effect of it, if it's beneficial, right? We talk about beneficial. It's beneficial to others, right? It's good karma, too. And both to others and ourselves, it's good karma. Things which are beneficial to ourselves but bad to other people, it's not good karma. So the idea about this karma is this, that. When you get this idea that, right, then we can start to slowly change ourselves to bring about more good karma from us. I mean, sometimes when we criticize others, usually it's bad karma if we put our own personal opinion in the way. I don't like you doing that, therefore I tell you off. That's bad karma. But if you look at it, it's not take away that I don't like you doing it and think that, know that when you do this, you are going to get into big trouble. Then if I say something to you, then that is good karma. Good counsel, good advice is good karma. But criticism as such, bringing our own ego out, is not good karma. So that's the way we look at it, wholesome and unwholesome. Now, when you talk about it, all these things, I always used this example of bad karma. But in, when you come to here, when you start to be able to look clearly into this perception and this, especially this mental formation, and look into our intention, if we can really arrest them in time, right, just to hold them back, or just to get rid of that, the thing, and know that bad intention or evil intention is forming in my mind, we start to clear them off, then we can avoid a lot of bad karma. But how to clear them off? So the Buddha says, okay, when you have got your body and the mind, you, or me, or whatever, come to contact with things, then sensation will develop, and through all this working of perceptions and all these things, the pleasantness and unpleasantness will come out, and of course that conditions the arising of craving, and when craving arises, it conditions the clinging to arise, and the clinging will allow becoming to arise, and so on. Now what you can do is go backwards. Supposing if we don't have the birth of this thing, there's no aging and death, okay? Supposing you don't have this intention and this becoming, there wouldn't be this birth of our action and deed. And if you don't have clinging, then all these things don't happen. If you don't have craving, then all these things don't happen. If you don't have sensation, right? All these things don't happen. And if you don't have contact, all the sensations don't happen. So the problem is not the contact, it's not the sensation. Because when we live in this world, you will come into contact with a lot of things. It is unavoidable. Now, there's some misconception about this Buddhist practice. A lot of people think that, okay, I got sick of, you know, quarreling people, having trouble with my surroundings and so on, I go bush. So I don't come into contact with all these nasty idiots. I don't hear all this horrible sound, no cars, no pollution, nothing. I go bush. But you can avoid all these things, right? You can avoid these five things. But in the bush, you still got your body. Yeah? Even though everything is pleasant, now if you get a kookaburra singing to you every morning, after a fortnight of kookaburra singing to you, 1 hour every morning, you say, go away, you bloody bird. So, again, quiet. That's his mind. The mind is still there. Now, if you go away, you sit down quietly, meditating, so-called. But if you don't apply our meditation in the right way, what happens is, you still think about things. You sit down there and they say, oh, that guy and my friend, I shot at him 2 rounds in the pub last night, 2 nights ago, and he didn't even return 1 shout. So, you get angry. Okay. It's working. Although you don't come into contact with those things, our mind will go. And I told you, the mind can travel as far as the end of the galaxy. Right? So, we can't avoid this contact. We can't avoid this sensation because we are human beings.
But what we can do within our own thing is do not allow this craving to start. The Buddha has taught in this teachings, the Buddha actually teaches how to cut the link. Now in a lot of teaching it says if you don't get born, even that this body and the mind, nothing happens, but the problem is you are here already. Instead of hanging yourself or killing yourself, we can do something about it without the drastic action of getting rid of ourselves. Train between this and this, there's a link. Cut this link off. Just go to the example I gave just now about this car screeching. What actually happened is, if you look it in the true nature of the thing, the true nature of it is actually a sound. And we reacted to the sound. It was there, car screeching. Therefore, blah, 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 blah. Now, if you start to say, okay, I know that this is sound I heard, or at the most, the car screeching I heard, it's not a pleasant sound. Let it go. So this is another word which the Buddha taught us. Let go of what? Attachment. Everybody knows the word attachment. Let go of your attachment. And the attachment starts here. This is actually, all of this is attachment. When you start to have this I, ego and all these things, attachment. When you start to have this craving, that's the beginning of attachment. So, get rid of this. And you don't react, you are just cutting off this link here. The teachings of the Buddha is to make us do this. And the Buddha spent a lot of time explaining this whole thing. You can say, you want to talk about the core of Buddha's teaching is one thing. That's in the little pistachio nut. If you look into the Buddhist scripture, you find that more than half of it is devoted to this mindfulness, explaining mindfulness and how to train for mindfulness. And just now Binta was telling you, just watch your breath. What does that lead to? It's the beginning of being mindful. Mindful of one thing which you do every day, every second, every minute. Anybody has stopped breathing for half an hour now? Yeah. And yet, it's vital. If you don't breathe for more than 5 minutes, most of us will die. I think it was the maximum, 8 minutes or something. So if you don't breathe, you're going to die. If you don't go up straight away, right? If you don't eat, maybe you won't die for a few days. So that's the most important, and yet we know more about the food we eat than about this breathing. So that mindfulness starts with the breathing. Start with being focusing your mind on the breathing. Now that goes to the other thing. I've spoken to you about this noble truth, okay? So the first noble truth is I quite hesitate to use the word suffering or unsatisfactoriness because it doesn't really convey the whole thing. Sometimes when you're happy, you're still in a state of dukkha. Right? No? You can give so many examples of when you're happy, you're in the state of dukkha, because the moment you're happy, what happens the next moment? Will it last? Suppose we meet somebody who is so attractive, right? Maybe you meet a person so attractive, fall in love and so on. And the first thing is, you know, while you are still happy having the relationship, you think, how long is it going to last? Will he or she leave me? Eh? All this will come in. And if really happiness can be really as good as we think it is, think. When was how long was your happiness when you had it last time? All these are the truth. So, this word dukkha means all this unsatisfactoriness we have. Eh? And then, in this dukkha, we talk about the physical ones, meaning the birth. The way, you know, when you're born, because after the birth, you can get a whole series of things. Then, the physical one will be the aging, sickness, and death. Right? And then the other one will be the sort of mental and physical dukkha, which comes out of, to be associated with things which we do not like, we can't avoid that, we can't push it hard enough, we can't get
enough of the things which we like, or we cannot have the situation of present verse all the time. This is the nature of existence. So this is dukkha, as the Buddha explained. Then the one is the causes of dukkha. Now, these causes, we talk about this, at first we explain the existence of impermanence, of no permanent self, of, again, of dukkha. Then the quality cessation. How dukkha can cease. Dukkha ceases when we are able to let go of everything. And it's going to allow our craving to affect us, then we don't have this dukkha. If I'm thinking now, if I got, again, take the example of this tea. I think it's tea inside there, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you want to say, I'm so used to good Chinese tea, right? I wonder if they're going to give me a $5 tea or a $16 tea. There you are, dukkha exists. But if I say, I'm grateful that they give me a cup of tea, I'll drink it regardless, letting go, then I got no dukkha. If I start to say, okay, this tea is not as good as the one I ate now, I had last Dhamma talk, then I get a problem. Okay, so that is the thing, right? You're able to let go. And the state of letting go completely, right? The state of it, now, not many of us experience that. It's only when you go into your practice, right? And being able to develop this mindfulness, and from this mindfulness, we are able to watch all these things and don't grip onto it, be able to break this chain, then we, the end of the thing, when you can completely get rid of it, the state of mind we are in is what we call nirvana. Right? It's not something which you click your heels and say, oh, I'm here, I'm more powerful than I was. Nothing of the sort. It's just, everything is just so nice, so quiet, so peaceful. Right? Whether it's a $5 tea, whether it's a $100 tea, it tastes the same to me. Not to pretend, but just to make sure that the mental state does not really differentiate all these things. Whether you're wearing a jacket, whether you're wearing a piece of cloth over you, it's the same. So that is the way this is the thing that will come. And you let go of things completely, let go of this unwholesome thing completely. And then of course this is the path to cessation of dukkha. Now this when you talk about that, it's still up to this stage. 1, 2, and 3 is still very theoretical. It's conceptual, make you understand things. Okay, I got this, I got that, blah 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 blah. But when you walk out there, it's going to effect on you. Still, when you go down there, somebody bump into you. Why don't you say, excuse me, when they bump into me? So what he did was, the Buddha talked about this path. And this path is what we call practice. And in Buddhism, practice means, what they use, the word they use is cultivation. Cultivation, I think, is a very good word. Cultivate what? The mental field we have out here. The mental states. To cultivate it to make it better. No, in to put, actually, there's a saying to put Buddhism in a nutshell. Right? In a nutshell, it means just few words. Evil, no stress. You do good, no stress. Purify the mind, all the stress gone. So it's very important. That's the gist of the Buddha's teaching. But why did I talk so much and not saying these 7 words in the first place? Because if you are not mindful how to avoid evil, you are not mindful how to do good, and if you don't purify the mind, how to be mindful? So you see, Buddhism don't tackle things just like that. The Buddha can jolly well do like other teachers. But why you will do good? Then scare you with a lot of things. You don't You don't avoid evil, the devil will come for you. If you do good, then you can come into my heaven. Right? If you don't do that, the Buddha says, what you will do good, purify the mind. And it's through this purification of the mind that we can develop mindfulness and avoid evil and do good. So it's a, I told you before, it's a very, very simple thing. Everybody, it's only through misunderstanding or through our ignorance and not knowing this thing. Therefore, we don't find a breakthrough in it. It's not easy to break through the mind, because the what a lot of teachers are saying, our delusion and our ignorance is so thick that sometimes we cannot break through. Now, there's a saying, there's a story that when the Buddha, after the Buddha gained his enlightenment, where he saw things clearly, he sat down there enjoying his, you know, the bliss which he get through a calm mind. And he said, okay, from now on, I just sit down there and just wait until the time my physical age is finished, then I just disappear. But it seems one of the gods came from heaven and begged him to go and teach people. I mean, of course, that's a story. It's a metaphor, sort of story. And the Buddha says, it's not easy to teach them. Because when you teach people that, you're actually pointing out the faults. Right? You're like that, you're like that, you're like that. And how many people like people pointing at the faults? So the Buddha says, no, it's quite difficult, because this thing is simple and yet difficult to teach. Then the God told the Buddha, he says, there are a lot of people with a lot of dust in their eyes, but there are a lot of people with little dust in their eyes. So as far as we are concerned, Buddhism is concerned, you only can convince people with little dust in their head, in their eyes. The little dust meaning that they know that there is this dukkha within me. I know that I'm suffering, I've got this unsatisfactoriness in me. A lot of people just deny it. I come across a lot of people, not few. I was quite surprised, because you know, to me, from very young days, I know that I've got all these problems. But a lot of people say, no, I got no problems. I got no problems. But then you just quarrel with somebody. No, they quarrel with me, I'm not quarreling with them. They cannot, the dust is so heavy that they cannot even break through. So what you do is, for the Buddhist teachings, it works only with people with little dust in their eyes. And of those of you guys who already, yes, I have got this, I got that, this makes sense and so on, then there's a chance of us to do it. There's a chance of us to purify the mind. In other words, that has got to be voluntary. We can't simply grab a person and say, yeah, come, meditate, I want to change you. The more we do that, the worse it gets. And that's why a lot of people go out and tell them Buddhism is no good. So, when you talk about this thing, I'll be talking to you 2 weeks' time, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. I'll be talking about the practice, this cultivation business. So, we go into a more practical thing. Tonight, I talk about this, a lot about this theoretical part. And if you think that it works, it states your condition. Now, that is a very funny thing. When I was holding a Buddhism course in the Buddhist library, very often I get people coming up to me after the course, after the class, and then they say, Jim, I don't know what sort of mind you have, but you can read everything I think about you. What you said just now is exactly like me. I say, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about me. It's all human minds, basically, we have the same way of behavior. We have got this grabbing and so on. And if you start to be able to allow yourself a bit of clarity of thinking, you can see that. And that is a very essential part in the Buddha's teaching. What the Buddha did is not to tell you what to do. Explain to us things and make you see it, and after that, make you think. That's what I like about Buddhism. That's what I like, not Buddhism, but the Buddha's teachings. The teaching, how he taught us. You look in the scripture, a lot of times when the Buddha tried to teach somebody, he did not say, believe in this, believe in that. It's what I say, it's what I say. He tells you, so what happens after this? Why do you do that? Let people think and give him the answer. If the answer is not right, okay, think again this way until they get it right. So this is the beautiful thing about the Buddha's teachings. When you find the answer yourself, the truth
is yours. Right? Of course, we share that truth, but we are really convinced about the truth. Right? So tonight, I'm just talking about it, and if you think that, okay, that fits into my pattern of thinking and so on, well, that truth is yours. It's not my truth either. What I do now is just repeating what the Buddha has taught 2,300 over years ago. And what is taught 2,300 years ago is still very, very relevant nowadays. Now for those of you who are psychology students, you'll find out that 80% of modern psychology comes from Buddhist teachings. And it's just developed over the past 50 or 60 years in its full strength. Okay, so any questions? Yes? No. I'm just using the simple... because the mind is something which is... we can't locate where the mind is. That's why I put in parentheses there.
When you say you have sense to you, you know, there's the truth to you, and I'm wondering though, with the car, I can, if it's just a sound, then I can detach and try not to let it create those feelings. If that screeching of that car is because of driving, which then down the road runs someone out.
No, because you attach to it, that's why. So the how you detach from it is because it might not have done so.
But if it
did, we don't know.
No.
You see, that's why the whole time our mind, that's another word I don't use, speculation.
Yeah.
We speculate. Right? And this speculation takes away a lot of our mental energy. It may not be. Even for what you know, a good thing we had, what somebody is doing, it may end up in exactly the same thing. Right? We try to speculate. Now, when it takes place, then you got to say it has taken place. Right? If you feel that, okay, if you feel very heavy about it, very bad about it, then no. You say it's not that we cannot cling on to things. It doesn't mean we cannot cling. But it did not say that we shouldn't cling. But what it tells you is, if you cling, this is going to happen. Right? So, you got a choice of either to cling or not to cling. It's about choice. It's, a lot of times people think, oh, why should he be so aloof to things? It's not really aloof to things. It's just that now we tend to look at things and say, okay, I think this is going to happen that way, therefore I cling on to it. So there are certain ways of, now if I were to be a petrol head, right, that screeching of car, I say, oh wow, whatever is that, you know, I'd be having a high on that thinking, you know, and it's going that fast and so on, right? But if I were to be like old man like me, I was thinking, that guy, what he did, even without seeing the thing, right? Say, that is a horrible thing to do, screeching at this time of the night or whatever. Right? This is a road. And then after that, I think, okay, you young guys, you got no manners at all, no road senses at all. Tomorrow I'm going to ring out Alan Jones and complain about it. You see? Brings up all the things. And while my mind is thinking about that, whether he, for what you know, he has gone home and have a good sleep, I'll be staying awake because of that. Right? That is the thing we are talking about.
I think what she was saying is that what if some guy actually is running along the streets, bridging their car, and actually hits someone, and you heard it?
Yeah.
And how do you get away?
Just go there. The next thing is, see whether you can help the body who is the person who's got the bank on it. Right? And then note down his car number, tell the police. I mean, that we are not, law is still law. Right? It doesn't mean that when we are good Buddhists, oh, you kill somebody, it's all right. No, there's such a thing as to do justice. But the most important is, when we do justice, are we really doing justice? Or we do justice because we hate somebody? Right? If I do, I say, I must complain about a guy, he hit the guy just now. Because I don't like him and so on, then that's not proper justice. If I say you just hit somebody, I must report to the police. Right? Not out of this kitchen. Now, that is a very difficult thing to do. That is a very difficult thing. Now, the more difficult is this part of it. Without having this strong emotion arising, can we do it?
Can I ask you another example to try and help me understand? I, in my local area, I'm near a river, and I've volunteered to go down and look at the generation. And in that time, what we do is we get bags out of the river, or we get ducks out of the river, and around them, or turtles out of the river, and bags around them. So I know. So when I see someone throw a bag in the street, my experience says that they can end up in the river and they can crush the people. How do I not feel bad about that?
Well, you don't have to feel
that person. I would rather the people not do that.
Can I challenge their behavior? Many times you can get away with it by telling them, please don't throw the thing. No, I mean, that's the whole thing. We got to know that when they do that to you, are you going to get upset or not? So if you can let go, we'll tell the person, okay, please don't throw it into the drain or throw it around, right? Because it might get into some wildlife, and we do whatever they do to abuse you, just take it. That is the whole thing. It's not that we cannot voice our opinion on injustice and all these things. Now, when you say you protest, we protest on this thing. We can protest. The Buddha did the protest. Therefore, when his own little principality, which he comes from, was being invaded by another king, what he did was sit in the middle of the road. And the king wouldn't just came down and just retreated. For three times he did that. But the fourth time, I think he knew that his own people are not that peaceful either. They're going to provoke the thing or whatever. So the fourth time, he just gave away his protest. So we can do that. A lot of things we can do. Now, that's what we call the engaged Buddhism. When you see poverty. Now, when you see somebody who's in poverty, a lot of people will go and shout at the rich people, yell at rich people, kill all the rich people so that you can distribute the wealth. That's not the way. You can go there and influence people to help others. So that is the way we look at it. Yes.
We talk about wholesome and unwholesome karma. Give an example of what neutral karma might be. Neutral karma.
A lot of things which possibly, as I told, very few. Like sometimes when you yawn, right? You don't have the intention. Actually, the intention is very, very small in yawning. It's just that you're tired and then it happens. It doesn't have any results at all. But when you yawn and then somebody doesn't like yawning, and you say, oh, it's bad karma. No, it's not that. It's his own bad karma, because he can't stand you yawning. You see, this karma theory is being overblown. Like I say, I tell you, this karma is actually in the cake which the Buddha preached, but this karma has been made into a lot of icing attached to it. So that's why there's a lot of stories about this karma. If you read some of the writings of some scholars and so on, they tell you a lot of things about karma. One of the things I like is he was saying that if you kill a chook in this life, next life you become a chook, and then the chook become a human being, you kill this little throat. So I mean, that sort of things is just based on belief. But what we know is the karma is what happens from moment to moment. This moment you've got evil intention and I want to say something insulting to people. Then the next moment when I say something insulting, there you are, the karma is done already. When I say that karma is done, while I was thinking of saying something insulting to people, I'm not in the calm state of mind. While I'm not doing it, I'm doing the same thing, going out, swearing at people, then I'm not in a good state of mind. But what happens after that is indeterminate. If I swear at somebody, if I swear back at me, I swear back at him, then what happens? I create an enemy. And this enemy, if it's thought, both of us don't give up, what's going to happen is, you remember it, and next time I walk around the next corner, you come with a stick, bang. It might do that. So all these things can happen. So you see, the thing is, where it starts, I don't say why it starts, but where it starts. It starts with that intention of me wanting to swear. If I withhold the thing and say I'm not going to swear, what happens?
Nothing happens. Now, it happened to me 2 years ago. Now, although I claim to be a Buddhist teacher, but sometimes I still don't follow 100% of the Buddhist principles because of those. No, this mindfulness is not 100%. Right? You've got to keep on doing so that we can get more and more mindful. So one day I was doing this, there's a road rage, right? And this guy was really, really upset with me because I wouldn't allow him to get into the bus lane. I wanted to turn left. I just go in and then he was horning me. Then I turned left. He followed me. Right? And then he swung around to the opposite of the road. He came down walking from where Ellen sits, at the back there. He came. Now, that is a very short moment. During my unmindfulness, I've already created making me angry. But I mean, of course, when you talk to people, he shouldn't have been angry, right? But of course, that's his nature to get angry. So as you walk, I know that's going to be nasty. But again, you know, my profession as a gardener and horticulturist, I got a lot of sharp things in my car. Next to me, my secretaries are very, very sharp. So I was thinking, well, you come and you might get something. As you walk 3/4 way through, all of a sudden, right? It's not that I'm a chicken out, I've been through fights before. It's not a chicken out, I just, all of a sudden, there you are, it's unwholesome. Right? That thought, in that moment. So I stuck my head out and say, oh, I'm sorry. This one word, I'm sorry. And that guy, this is typical of the description you put on those gangster guy, you know? Nicely dressed, anyway. He stopped in the middle, and then all his swearing completely gone. And then he didn't know what to do, turned back, got in his car, slammed his door, and moved. Now, I tell you, you haven't said, I'm sorry. There'll be two sorry people. Eh? I could have easily, you know, just do that to his face with my secretaries, and then get a big, beautiful thing, and you got about 20 stitches up there. And then the next thing, I would have been going to jail, and then big headlines, Buddhist teacher assaulting me. So you see, that sort of thing is that momentary intention. If you can get rid of it, right? You hold on to it. And sometimes when I do things, we still do get angry out of habit. But if the moment when the mindfulness comes in the right moment, the anger goes on, and you don't bring the anger out to other people, then you diffuse a lot of this, what we call animosity. Right? Even sometimes you do things with good intention, you still create animosity. But if you can see, that's why we talk about this clarity of thinking, to see the true nature of things, right? How we react to things. It's not how they provoke us, but how we react to it. If somebody provokes me, if I refuse to accept the provocation, nothing happens. And sometimes I try to irritate people that way, you know, when I'm nasty. You know, you talk about a lot of things, you swear at me, I just smile at it. But there's, of course, there's bad karma too, you know, making more angry. Okay, any more questions? Yes?
I have a question about craving.
Uh-huh. It's not that they can't, it's just, you see, if you look at it, the craving is stronger than the intention not to do it. Right? That clinging is very, very strong. Right? It's not only eating meat, you see people who are smoking, or people who are addicted to alcohol and all this, addiction. So if you say, if I cannot live without meat, it's also an addiction. Or, on the other hand, if the vegetarian say, I cannot live without vegetables, or I can't, I must have meat, it's also an addiction. Right? I must have vegetable and nothing else, it's also an addiction. Right? So what I've got to do is see how this starts. And the training is precisely that. It's just that the clinging is very, very strong, and over there, that's the other side of the mind tells them that I got to do it. Right? So while they cannot give up, they want to do it, let's cause this conflict, and therefore dukkha arises. So it's not about developing, now, when you talk about developing this thing, look into this mental formation or the willpower. Right? I find that it's much easier for people to give up the addictions once they start to
develop mindfulness through the meditation. It does not happen overnight. I mean, usually people say, my son wants to give up drugs, can you help him in this meditation? It takes a while. So this is the thing, we've got to look at it now. When you talk about this mind and all this thing, it's precisely that clinging of inside there, the subconscious clinging is stronger than the conscious want to let go. So in other words, it's just the pulling and the pushing. It's just like falling in love with somebody who knows it's really horrible. You can't let go, but you still want it.
Everything you say, right? You see, we are not tackling anger, we are not tackling fear and so on as it is. We are tackling the root of all these things, craving. Root of all these things, clinging. Right? Now, the Buddha gives us what we call an empirical formula. It applies in all conditions. Right? But the way we apply it could be different, you know, things we hear, things we see, or the different situations. So the meditation training is to allow us to develop this mindfulness and awareness, aware of where your mind is doing now. And once you know what your mind is doing, and also in what we call the mindfulness meditation, we can see also that this, when this develops, that develops, that develops, right? And you can see it's going to hit us into trouble. Now all these things happen in normal mind in a split second. And if you can really catch it in a split second, you can also diffuse it in a split second. And because it's a mental thing, it's not a physical thing. So that's why I'll be talking more about it in the next session on this practice. The practice is to be able to be aware of it. Now, this is one of the cases I tell you, but there are other cases I can tell you where I really got angry. I've told people off, right? I really got angry and not to say throwing tantrums, but after learning, doing this meditation and the other mindfulness, I find that a lot of things fewer things make me angry. Right? Or I get angry at fewer things. And I don't have the intensity of it. Right? Which means that a lot of things happen, I just sit down there and say, okay, starting to get angry. But sometimes, because, you know, we talk about this delusional ignorance, when I go into the path of ignorance, I still do get angry. But at least the thing is cooled down a little bit. So people around me don't really suffer that much. Or if they want to suffer that much, that's their business.
What's the Buddhist view about competition? Because sometimes it's unavoidable to be involved in competition, whether it's competition or competition. And being in that situation, it's either you win or you lose. So then you mean you can be happy at the same time, not that your competitor is there. And try to think of how to be mindful in that situation. Because if you win, if you know that
You see, in the competition, both you and the competitor have agreed to be in that sort of situation, right? Then, now, the difference in the Buddhist way is, when you win, say suppose you win a gold medal, and the guy has got a bronze medal,
Don't take the woman. See? Now that's the one thing you should avoid doing, right? And then when you win, look at the ego coming up. Now that's very important, this ego of us. Well, because when you get this ego, we tend to show. And then we tend to create a lot of ill feeling, ill will towards us. I used to play tennis long time ago, two friends, you know. And one, whenever he wins, he comes over and then I shake my hands. He says, "Unluck." The other one, when he wins, he throws his racket up. So you guess whom I like better. So this is the way, you know, you look at things that way. It's not that we shouldn't compete. In the Buddhist way, there's no competition. The Buddha never tell him, out of 10 disciples, you are 1 inch ahead of the other one, or you are 1 nose ahead. No such thing as that. It's just everybody can go according to their own ways. There's no, in other words, the thing is, where the Buddha talk about is there's no superiority because of the breed of your lineage and all these things. Only thing he gives superiority is when on the seniority of becoming a monk. So if you base on that, then the ego doesn't come in. And also he knew that in the other thing is, you know, in the whole India they got this 4 different caste system. So when the Buddha went back to Kapilavastu, to his own home country, a lot of these people come and try to ordain to become monks. And those people who come out, his people of his own caste, the higher caste people. So before he ordained them, he saw one of his barbers, ex-barbers, right? And he ordained the barber first, right? So that the barber can be senior to all these proud satriyas or the upper caste people. So you see that means when you look at it, when people who are in a superior position, if they are mindful, they shouldn't look at and think of the others as inferior. Right? That is the other part of Buddhism which is very important. We talk about this loving kindness and compassion. So in other words, you look at other people like us. Now suppose you are competing with others and you lose. What happens? No, we are not happy. If the fellow go and show off his winning, then you feel even worse. What you got to do is be, in other words, be friendly, be nice to others. There's a case where, you know, when the, you know, the Taliban in Afghanistan, they blew up the big Buddha statue in Bamiyan. It's a huge one. It's about something like 30 meters high, I think. Or no, 15 or 30 meters, a very, very high one, made of granite, in the middle of the desert. They blew up. And the next morning, one of those fellows come and ask me, you know, people who are not Buddhist, they said, look, headline news, they blew up the thing. How do you feel, Jim, as Buddhist? So I told him, I said, it's now becoming a pile of rocks, isn't it? It's a pile of rubble. That is the most important. That's why the Buddhists don't wage war against the Afghanistan. What's there? It's there. It was there. Now it's no longer there. It's of no use to anybody. So that's the way we look at it. And when we start to look at it, be mindful of it, then our feeling of bad feelings will slowly go down. It's not that you become nice people, but if you notice what happens within you is we become more calm, more peaceful, less affected by emotions and all this stuff. Any more questions? We've got time now. One last one. No, the thing is,
because there's a greater good, that there's a short-term evil, because it would be bad karma.
You see, when we say it's good or bad, then it becomes a case study. Then anybody who thinks that the other person is evil, then I should get rid of him. And in like now, we all think of Hitler as evil, right? But maybe it's true. But later on, when you start having these precedents, then people will say, okay, you know.
I don't like Kevin Rudd because of this policy is harming a lot of people, so get rid of him as well. So that's the whole thing we're talking about. But having said that, for a skillful Buddhist, he'll say, okay, he'll think, can we get rid of him without really, you know, stuffing him out? That's the whole thing. Now, if you look at the French Revolution and the way the Indians fought for the independence of India, there are two things, right? Getting rid of the oppressive government. The French Revolution killed a lot of people. The fight for independence for India, the killing is virtually, you know, very, very minimum. What happens after that, it's not that. It's just when they're fighting for independence. They didn't kill the British army at all. Whereas the French, they killed the nobility, they killed everybody. So it's the two psychology involved in it. Now, in the case of Gandhi, who is the head for the independence movement for India, he has got this great influence because what the word he uses are ahimsa, non-violence. And that concept comes through Hinduism from Buddhism. Because one of the right thoughts in the Eightfold Path is called non-violence, the feelings of non-violence. So what he did is how to get rid of them. Okay, they have civil disobedience. You don't have to really go and kill the white people to get independence. Right? So that is the way. And it's more skillful if you don't kill them. Okay.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, everyone.